Today in Studio 360, it's time for a redesign and upgrade of you and me.
It seems rather ridiculous that we back up our computers, but as far as our mind and, you know, brain is concerned, we just leave it up to whatever happens.
We'll talk to scientists and artists who are dreaming of how to move beyond the limits of our natural-born biological selves.
We're rebuilding humans from the ground up, literally.
My guest today is Gregory Stock, one of the big thinkers in genetics.
It sounds so compelling in a way, you know, the choice is, oh, we're going to take out a little bit of this and we're going to do a little bit of that and it's going to be the best of you. But actually, we don't have a clue when it comes to that what creates exceptional capabilities.
I'm Kurt Anderson. We'll preview the revised, new and improved you today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. Better. Stronger. Faster.
The dream of using technology to make us better, stronger, faster didn't start with the $6 million man. Although, adjusted for inflation, he'd now be the $30 million man. Still a bargain. All the way back in 1850, Edgar Allan Poe wrote a short story about a hero of the Indian Wars who seems perfect. Well-spoken, robust, great-looking, men envy him, ladies love him.
The arms altogether were admirably modeled, nor were the lower limbs less superb. These were indeed the ne plus ultra of good legs.
Except Poe's narrator smelled something fishy.
There was a primness, not to say stiffness, in his carriage, a degree of measured, and if I may so express it, of rectangular precision, attending his every movement.
Eventually, he discovers that the general was massacred in battle. Just about all of him is clever machinery, put together by cutting-edge 1850 craftsmen. That exciting-slash-creepy vision of re-engineering our bodies has appeared over and over ever since then. But our ability to improve on nature is no longer just a fantasy. We seem close to a tipping point. Gregory Stock is a biophysicist and biotech entrepreneur whose basic attitude is full speed ahead. The title of his 2002 book pretty much says it all, Redesigning Humans, Our Inevitable Genetic Future.
What's interesting and why these things are so inevitable is that it's all the short-term things that everybody is interested in that are laying the foundation for the larger changes that are so much more difficult and challenging and compelling in some ways. When people talk about genetic interventions, the active genetic interventions, they fall into two classes. One is somatic interventions, which could, you know, if you have an immune system that isn't working as well as it should, and you could maybe seed that with some or make a little genetic alteration to improve that. So it's one that's very narrowly and limited to the adult. And the other would be what is called germline interventions, which involve the first cell of the body, the germinal cell, the embryo, in which case that change is then copied into every cell in the body. And so affects the organism as a whole. When you begin to understand life and living processes at a very profound level, which is absolutely required if you're going to deal with cancer and Alzheimer's and all sorts of things of that sort, then you open up the possibility of making other interventions that would be categorized as enhancement interventions and that are touching temperament and personality and genetic manipulation. So the technology is lowering the bar to the kinds of applications that will challenge us as a society.
But that's really the there is a, it seems to me, a fairly bright line, a Rubicon between, okay, preventing disease and suffering, fixing problems that are going to be horrible for a human to have versus the improvements, the enhancements.
Absolutely, because we can nudge that process in one way or another to make it serve our interests, to be able to add value to our lives. But with genetics, if you do any kind of polling, you see that between a third and two-thirds of the population, even a little bit higher than that if you poll in China or Thailand or some of the Eastern cultures, that where parents say if they could enhance the genetics of their children, enhance their either cognitive or physical capabilities, they would absolutely do it. So you try and ban these things and you just drive it underground and push it away from control.
Are there imaginable genetic interventions where you, Greg Stock, said, I don't like the sound of that?
I think that the kinds of things that worry me are ones that are interventions that are driven not by a sense of what seems to be of value and to benefit to the individual who's involved, but are ones that are kind of abstract, where the government is trying to enhance some quality or is trying to alter the makeup of the population in some way.
Eugenics, as we used to call it.
Yeah. So it's government-driven eugenics, but it could take all sorts of forms. All of our sensitivities are going to be stepped on by these possibilities when people are beginning to make choices. And the most obvious of that, which was challenging for me, is to encounter numbers of deaf parents who would use this technology to choose to have a deaf child, because then they feel they would have a closer relationship with the child, it would be integrated into the community of the deaf, and yet that's could be perceived and is perceived by many as, negative eugenics. I mean, you're basically diminishing the capabilities of a child.
Yeah.
And so
In the more dystopian scenarios, I'm reminded in our discussion of a movie that came out in 1997 called Gattaca. I want to just play a clip from that if I can.
Your extracted eggs, Marie, have been fertilized with Antonio's sperm. After screening, we are left, as you see, with two healthy boys and two very healthy girls. Naturally, no critical predispositions to any of the major inheritable diseases. All that remains is to select the most compatible candidate. You have specified hazel eyes, dark hair, and fair skin. I have taken the liberty of eradicating any potentially prejudicial conditions. Premature baldness, myopia, alcoholism, and addictive susceptibility, propensity for violence, obesity, etc.
We didn't want... I mean, diseases, yes, but...
Right. We were just wondering if it's good to just leave a few things to chance.
You want to give your child the best possible start. Believe me, we have enough imperfection built in already. No, your child doesn't need any additional burdens. And keep in mind, this child is still you. Simply the best of you. You could conceive naturally 1,000 times and never get such a result.
That's a scene from Gattaca, the 1997 science fiction film. Now, does that sound like a realistic version of a scene that might take place in 20 years?
It might. It's interesting, but that sense, certainly not in 20 years and that sort of broad kind of selection, but what's really interesting is that film toys with our imagery and our associations of our ideas about perfection. And you notice that that sounds so compelling in a way, the choice is, we're going to take out a little bit of this and we're going to do a little bit of that and it's going to be the best of you. But actually, we don't have a clue when it comes to that what creates exceptional capabilities. I mean, it's this intersection of our experience of a whole number of factors. It's the strange things that happen. It's the person who had to deal with incredible challenges because they were crippled or they were in a very harsh environment or whatever it is that brings out something special in them.
And what we don't want to see, as you're suggesting, is the sort of Botox version of genetic enhancement where everything becomes dull and homogenous.
I absolutely agree with that. And I think, though, that when you really think about the way people apply other technologies, that's very unlikely to happen.
Right.
It is going to get weird, okay? And not necessarily a place that I myself will personally be comfortable with. I think there's a sense that, you know, a lot of the distaste for these possibilities comes from the sense that they are strange, that they're unfamiliar. Yet our place isn't to try and limit those choices.
Right.
And determine that the shape of a future that we really can't envision in any real way.
Well, one of the issues that worries people and was part of the Gattaca scenario is that there's this economic divide. And in Gattaca, there was this underclass of people who aren't genetically enhanced and they're looked down upon and discriminated against. But is that a serious issue to worry about for the next 50, 100 years as this becomes more possible?
I think that is absolutely not the way it's going to play out, in that the gap is not going to be between rich and poor. It's going to be based on age, basically, in terms of one generation to the next, because the capabilities are going to get so much more powerful as we move forward. If you looked at a dividing line that might occur, it's going to be philosophical. There's been greater resistance on the side of generally the Christian faiths as opposed to, say, Buddhism or some of the Eastern religions. And, you know, who's going to choose to use these things? So it's going to be we're going to begin to manifest our philosophies in our biology.
So yet another way in which the 21st century is going to be China and India's century, I guess.
Maybe, or maybe we'll turn around really fast. I don't know.
My guest is Gregory Stock, who is a biophysicist and a biotech entrepreneur and thinker. We are talking about redesigning human beings, to borrow the title from one of his books. Hollywood, of course, can't get enough of this stuff.
And then I felt it.
The movie Limitless featured Bradley Cooper as a blocked, unsuccessful novelist who gets a hold of a secret new drug, a pill that allows him suddenly to use 100% of his brain. His life is transformed. Among other amazing mental powers, he's now able to tap into and use every memory in his brain.
I was blind, but now I see.
Real neuroscience is making some staggering leaps, and we sent Sally Herships out to explore the frontier of memory research.
Before we get to memory, let's talk about plastic surgery for a second. The nose jobs and tummy tucks that are so common today got their start on the battlefield.
Where that started was really in the First World War.
Anjan Chatterjee teaches neurology at the University of Pennsylvania. He told me soldiers were surviving disfiguring injuries, so doctors started figuring out how to reconstruct their faces. Fast forward a few decades.
What started out as a medical intervention for reconstructive purposes started to be used in healthy people.
And that's how it goes with a lot of medical technologies. Therapy for the sick becomes enhancement for the healthy. Chatterjee sees it in his field. He calls the phenomenon cosmetic neurology.
Back in the 70s, when I was in college, it used to be that people took drugs to check out, and now they take drugs to check in.
Like Adderall. It's supposed to help with ADHD, but college kids, maybe as many as 25% of them, are using it without a prescription. They say it helps them sharpen focus and concentration, giving them a competitive edge, as easy as popping a pill. But what if improving memory was even easier? So you're talking about putting hardware into our brains.
That's exactly right. And actually not putting the hardware so much in the brain, but yes, putting electrodes into the brain.
Ted Berger teaches biomedical engineering at the University of Southern California. He's trying to help patients with memory loss, like his mom. She had a series of strokes and suffered brain damage. She was no longer able to create new memories. His research has to do with how one part of the brain, the hippocampus, transforms thoughts into memories, although we don't know exactly what the hippocampus does.
Whatever it does, it transforms them in such a way that they become long-term memories. They're capable of being stored somewhere else in the brain. If they're not transformed the way the hippocampus transforms them, then you can't store it. That's what it boils down to.
Ted Berger wants to build a device that would act as an artificial hippocampus, Right now, it's still in the research phase. Berger is working with rats. But here's the idea. The device has two parts. The electrodes he mentioned would go in your brain. They'd record memories as you create them in the form of electrical signals. Then they'd send the information to a tiny microchip hidden under the skin on your skull. People with long-term memory problems, like Alzheimer's or dementia patients, would be able to use Berger's artificial hippocampus instead of their own.
We can connect our microchip so that it plugs into the hippocampus the right way. So now it can go back to transforming inputs into the right kind of outputs so they can become long-term memory.
Again, this is still experimental, years away from being used in humans. What Berger is doing right now is teaching rats a new task, like how to push a lever. While they're learning, he's recording the activity in their brains. When neurons in the brain, rodent or human, do work, they give off electrical signals, kind of like Morse code.
So if you connect it to a speaker, it'll have a sound. Just bup, 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 bup.
What you're listening to now is the sound of a rat's memory.
When you're hearing, you know, bup, 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 that's a low, we color that with a low blue.
And if the output is high, then it's colored more of an orange and red.
So you can see these streams of blue, green, orange, red, blue, blue, red, blue, you know, coming out of each one of these neurons. And so you have this the space-time color code, which represents the actual memory for a given event.
I am... That's like the coolest thing ever.
It is cool.
Wow.
Sometimes we stop being scientists and go, wow, that's cool. You can't help it.
Any more than you can help being yourself, which is maybe why people are so freaked out by the idea of tinkering with memory. Berger's research is directed towards therapy. But if it works, will someone one day find a way to make therapy into enhancement?
What was that series of Matt Damon movies where he's sort of a programmed...
Yes, great movies.
Yeah.
Why can't I remember the name?
I don't know. No,
we need your... Really...
It is pretty appropriate that neither of us can remember.
You know the one I'm talking about where he's a professional...
Yes.
Killer and
a professional hitman.
And his memory has been completely altered, right?
That's right.
Finally, we Googled it. We're talking about the Bourne identity. The main character is a CIA assassin. His entire identity is a series of false memories implanted by the government.
Now, I want to know what happened in Marseille.
I don't remember what happened in Marseille.
This is unacceptable, soldier. You hear me? You failed.
Unacceptable.
You failed. You failed and you're going to tell me why.
I can't tell you. I don't remember.
Berger says that his research could never lead to a Bourne scenario. There's no way it could implant a memory. Good thing, right?
Who we are is in large part defined by what we remember. And because we respond to what we remember, it controls our behavior in a lot of different ways. Could someone insert new memories into me or into someone else? No. I mean, that's... I don't want to wake up one day with somebody else's memories. I want my own, thank you.
But Ted Berger doesn't know any better than the rest of us where his research might lead a decade or two from now. Maybe the CIA will try someday to program a super assassin. But I bet I know who's going to beat them to the punch. A college kid who hasn't started Moby Dick. And the final is tomorrow. For Studio 360, I'm Sally Herships.
Call me Kurt Anderson, and coming up, forget implanted memories. How would you like a new pair of legs?
I just want to upgrade. That's not weird. People go to the gym to do that. The only difference is I have access to better technology.
You crushed your other leg.
Yeah.
On purpose.
Yes.
Why?
That's ahead in Studio 360. Stay with us.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. And if you're in New York next month, come join me for an event that I'm really excited about. It's called An Evening of Ignorance. My main collaborator is the Columbia University neuroscientist Stuart Feierstein, who says it's not what we know that really matters in science. It's what we don't know yet. He and some other top scientists and I will talk about some of the crucial unknowns in genetics, the environment, language, and the shape of the universe. If we do our job right, you'll leave with more questions than answers. It's September 20th in New York City, and you can get more details and tickets at studio360.org. And today on the show, we are delving into science a little bit as well with the ultimate self-help topic for the whole species, designing enhanced human beings. When the original Bionic Woman was a primetime TV show in the 1970s, the real field of biomechatronics was just getting started. Today, with so many injured soldiers and Marines returning home from Afghanistan and Iraq, scientists and engineers are working hard now to eliminate the gap between 20th century fiction and 21st century reality. Studio 360's Jonathan Mitchell has more.
At the beginning of the novel Machine Man by Max Barry, the main character's left leg is severed.
It wasn't as bad as it sounds. Well, it was. It was agonizing.
He spends months recovering in a hospital. They give him a wheelchair, but Charlie just wants to walk. And then he meets Lola.
Hi.
An expert in prosthetics.
I hear you got a transfemoral.
Before I could respond, she lifted up my sheet.
Ooh, they weren't kidding. That's a clean stump.
She rolled the sheet up to my waist and put her elbows on the bed so she could look at it from up close.
Some kind of a machine accident, yes?
A clamp.
Wow, you hit the jackpot. This is amazing. If you're planning to do the other leg, you should definitely use the same method. I'm serious.
What?
I'm kidding. You want to see some legs?
Charlie works for a high-tech company called Better Future. They make all kinds of products that are supposed to make our lives better. And he's a scientist. He's got access to resources. So he starts to wonder, what if I made a better leg?
When you thought about it, biological legs couldn't do anything except convey a small mass from A to B, so long as A and B were not particularly far apart and you were in no hurry. That wasn't great. The only reason it was ever notable was that legs did it using raw materials they grew themselves. If you were designing something within that limitation, then okay, good job. But if you weren't, it seemed to me you could build in a lot more features.
It looks heavy.
It's about 180 pounds. It tends to dent the floor.
How do you lift it?
I don't. It walks by itself. Lola looked at me. The foot rotates. It's essentially an orbital wheel on a shifting multidimensional axis.
And what's this?
Oh, the processor. I'm not really happy with the positioning on that. It's a little vulnerable.
What does it do?
You know, basic monitoring and control. GPS, data storage, Wi-Fi.
Your leg has Wi-Fi?
It has to. Otherwise, it couldn't interface with the online pathfinding API. Lola looked back at the leg. She knelt on the floor before it. The leg was under a lab spotlight, looking like a steel vase. It bulged at the bottom because the foot was the size of a backpack and tapered to a slimmer thigh. My lab assistants had performed excellent work in metals fab this week. I'd never seen them so motivated. Lola reached out and touched the leg. Her fingers ran down the metal.
It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
And it's completely fictional. But there are actually real people in the real world working on this right now.
We're building body parts.
And they're getting pretty good at it.
My name is Hugh Herr. I'm associate professor at MIT. I direct the biomechatronics group.
He also has a company called iWalk.
We're rebuilding humans from the ground up, literally.
Hugh Herr is sort of the real-life version of the Charlie character in Machine Man. He's a double amputee, and he's wearing iWalk's latest product.
A bionic foot ankle limb. It's called the Biome.
That sound you hear isn't a sound effect. It's his robotic feet walking across the room.
The ankle has a synthetic motor system that moves it. Five very small computers and 12 sensors. So the ankle, the synthetic ankle, moves as if it's made of flesh and of bone.
They're silver and black and robotic. They're like something out of Fritz Lang's Metropolis. And they give him a completely normal gait. He walks at normal speeds.
I mountain climb, I run, I jog for recreation, I play tennis, I hike. I basically do what I want to do. Now, what's interesting to note is if you take the technology from me, if you remove it from my body, all I can do is crawl. When I was a teenager, I was an avid mountain climber. When I was 17, I was, while climbing, struck by a vicious blizzard with my climbing partner, Jeff Batzer. What we intended as a day outing turned into 4 days. We both suffered severe frostbite and hypothermia. After months of effort, my medical team gave up the struggle to save my biological legs, and they were amputated below the knee, March 24th, 1982. In that accident, my partner lost fingers and one of his leg, and there was a rescuer, Albert Dow, who perished while looking for us on the mountain.
Rock climbing was a huge part of Hugh Herr's life, and he didn't want to stop. So he devoted himself to finding a way to climb again.
I first designed limbs to augment my height, be as short as 5 feet, as tall as I'd like. Limbs that could wedge into small rock fissures where a human foot cannot penetrate. Limbs that would penetrate an ice wall surface. I was actually able to climb at a more advanced level with artificial limbs than I'd ever achieved before the accident with biological limbs.
He went on to get his PhD, and he studied robotics so that he could restore the lost functionality of severed limbs. Today he holds 14 patents.
The artificial part of my body is, in fact, a blank palette for which to create.
Right now his lab is working on ways of connecting these limbs to our brains so we can feel a sandy beach or hot asphalt.
The next step is to say, well, maybe we shouldn't be cell and tissue centric. Maybe we shouldn't view our biological hand as the end all. Maybe that bionic hand is also okay and acceptable. And perhaps beyond that, when we experience the biological hand being stiff in the morning and maybe even being painful and arthritic, maybe that bionic hand over there will actually be attractive.
And Hugh Herr says that might lead to a time when this technology might even be embraced by the able-bodied.
People with quote-unquote normal minds and bodies, I predict, will volunteer to use these technologies to go beyond what nature intended.
That's what happens in Max Berry's book Machine Man. Charlie's prototype is so good, he wants another.
You crushed your other leg.
Yeah.
On purpose.
Yes.
Why?
Because I couldn't think how to explain it. It seemed obvious. She had seen my prototype.
Do you want to die?
No.
Do you hate yourself?
No. Well, I considered. There were parts of which I didn't have a very high opinion, but I didn't hate them. I just thought they could be better. You do physical therapy. You make people sweat and struggle and do painful exercises. You have pierced ears. Did you puncture your earlobes because you hate yourself? Are you working your way up to suicide? I just want to upgrade. That's not weird. People go to the gym to do that. The only difference is I have access to better technology.
I receive completely new limbs every 3 to 5 years. And when I get rid of my limb set, I'm not depressed. I don't cry. However, in the future, I can imagine that when my bionic limbs are more intimate with my biology when they're mechanically linked to my skeleton through an osseoimplant, when my nervous system is completely interfaced with the bionic limb. I can imagine that I will have a deeper relationship, emotional relationship, with the synthetic part of my body.
And maybe one day, our machines will be so good, we'll love them as though we grew them ourselves. For Studio 360, I'm Jonathan Mitchell.
You can see some of the artificial limbs from Hugh Herr's company iWalk at studio360.org. And now I'm joined once again by the biophysicist Gregory Stock, who is the author of Redesigning Humans, as well as other books. Greg Stock, do you think that what Hugh Herr has done there to compensate for the loss of his, as he says, biological legs, will be seen 50, 100 years from now as some kind of version 1.0 of what is common?
Yes, I think it's fabulous. I really I love that story, and there are others that have done not as deeply. I haven't heard that's a very his vision and understanding that he's achieved is really wonderful. You have Oscar Pistorius, who has artificial sort of bouncy lower legs that can run the 100-meter dash in 10.5 seconds. The thing is that they're relatively narrow domain applications at present. What would be really interesting with Hugh is at this stage whether if he could have his limbs back, even though he would not be as good a climber, if he would do that. I suspect he probably still would do that at this phase. But I think he really gets that understanding of how we can have technological extensions of ourselves that we really grow to love and grow to feel as a part of ourselves. You know, you don't have to go beyond the iPhone to see that.
I was thinking.
I mean, people love them.
Exactly. And people, when Steve Jobs died, talked again and again about the way in which Apple has made people love their technology. And there's no question that that's become true. And as you've suggested, they've become more an intimate part of how we behave hour to hour.
Yeah. And I see it just as the clumsy beginnings of that. It really is. It's when you think of the possibilities of where that's going to go as the technology enhances, as we understand more about ourselves, it is really mind-boggling. And those are ones that are implanted and ones that are outside of ourselves, that are close to us, that make us sort of a functional cyborg.
You compare what's going on now as the beginning stage of something comparable to a profound evolutionary inflection point from millions of years ago, when suddenly vertebrates were possible and larger life forms were possible. What's interesting, that gets to the lots of people's concern, squeamishness, problem with this whole thing, I guess, is evolution, as we have known it, is about random mutations. And what we're talking about is choice, and with it the scary, thrilling sense that human beings have control over their world in a way that they haven't previously.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. The common view of evolution is that we have this sort of random trial and error process that is operating on life in some way and that is shaping it. And that's true, but at some other level, it's really not random. There are all sorts of design mechanisms that try and increase the number of successful outcomes, because if it was truly random, then nothing would ever work. So there have to be ways of sort of directing the population of novel attempts. And that evolutionary process itself, therefore, in fact, evolves. You can't build an aircraft carrier by, you know, random combinations of individual small parts. It has to be a gradual process of change building upon prior successes. There just wouldn't be enough time in the universe to do it otherwise. As we've been able to improve medicine, you know, extend survival from childhood diseases, we essentially take out a lot of the evolutionary trial and error that occurs, which affects reproductive success.
And I guess as a technological super optimist. You have faith that as we extend lives and thus increase the population beyond what it would happen, that we will also figure out a way to deal with 12, 15, 20 billion and beyond.
Well, I don't know that the numbers of people will expand. I think those are pretty old projections, but why not more? I mean, people used to live until the life expectancy 100 years ago was 40. And, you know, now it's in the high 70s. And my feeling is that if we extended that and life were 200 years long, that, you know, it might be an adjustment, but in a very short period of time, we would redefine the nature of our expectations about the trajectory of life.
As you look forward, let's say 100 years, since I and many of the listeners presumably can imagine having grandchildren who will be alive 100 years from now, do you have any kind of specific scenario in this realm of what will be possible 100 years hence?
Well, I have a 7-year-old daughter and one that happens to have been conceived in a petri dish. So I've been, you know, a part of advanced reproductive technologies. And I feel she is the luckiest little girl alive. And, you know, we do, by and large, live normal human lifespans still. Cancer and heart disease, the number one killers. You get Alzheimer's, your brain goes to mush. I mean, we're sort of like a dying animal. We're stuck to our bodies, and yet our minds can soar. And so we're embarked on a journey to we know not where. And ironically, I look at it as almost an act of faith, that I really believe that it's very likely to end well. If I could live longer myself, I would love it.
Greg Stock, thank you so much.
Okay, well, it's been a pleasure, and thank you for having me as a guest.
Gregory Stock is a biotech entrepreneur and the author of Redesigning Humans, Our Inevitable Genetic Future. So what do you think? If you could tweak your genome at will, what would be first on your to-do list? Increased lung capacity? Get thinner? Improve your vision or your memory? Tell us at studio360.org. Coming up, an artist gets ready for the post-human future.
As much as I like being human and as much as I respect our humanity, we're just not all that smart.
I say we can do better than that.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and today we're looking at how scientists and designers are drawing up blueprints for human beings 2.0. All the tinkering we've talked about today, from genetic engineering to artificial limbs, simply improves on the base model we've been born with. But for some people, that doesn't go far enough. There's a movement of people who call themselves post-humanists or transhumanists. Studio 360's Eric Malinsky talked to one of its true believers and to one of its toughest critics.
When Natasha Vita Moore was 11 years old, she noticed a bump inside her mouth. It kept growing bigger until her mother brought her to see a specialist.
I had an aggressive tumor in my jaw, which was basically eating up the bone mass within my jaw.
The doctor removed the tumor, and her jaw grew back. But for a long time, she had to go to a plastic surgeon's office for follow-up visits.
And in the waiting room, I saw the most astonishing and poignant levels of deformity and necessary reconstructive surgery.
Most kids would be scared, not her.
It was shocking, to be sure, but it was more enlightening than anything to have gone through this at such an early age, seeing how humans are malformed and what can be done through surgery, through medical technology, to restructure our bodies.
When Natasha grew up, she became a sculptor, painter, even a fitness model. But she couldn't shake this image of kids who were like dolls needing replacement parts. And she started to have these really far-out ideas, like, Why can't we grow new limbs and just keep them around as spare parts? Why can't we back up our memories on a hard drive?
It seems rather ridiculous that we back up our computers, and we're so conscientious about that. But as far as our mind and, you know, brain is concerned, we just leave it up to whatever happens.
Natasha met with scientists in every field, looking for any way that science could eventually help improve our bodies, from bioengineering to nanotechnology. She poured everything she learned into a high-concept work of art, a computer-generated image of a new and improved human body.
It's a naked body, and it's my body that is used for the prototype of Primo Posthuman.
That's the name of the project, Primo Posthuman.
The first one looked more like a cyborg, like a Lamborghini car ad, you know, faster, sleeker, smoother.
It actually looked kind of like the instruction manual to the Bionic Woman. It had replaceable genes, enhanced intelligence. The lifespan was listed as ageless. A label points to the kneecap and says, solar-protected skin with tone texture changeability. Click on the label.
And you'll go to a description of how that particular part of the body can be re-engineered. So that would be a type of enhancement that would actually look similar to the human skin but could change and have a shimmer to it, like some animals in their feathers or the beautiful texture of a snake skin.
Well, I'm having flashes of Timothy Leary, Dr. Moreau, Henry Ford, and Steve Jobs all at once.
I think you're spot on.
Not everyone thought so. This was not long after Dolly the sheep was cloned, and people were afraid of messing around with nature too much. Natasha's weird art project did get a lot of attention, but some magazines made her out to be a self-obsessed kook.
I used to get very upset about it. In fact, I think I cried a number of nights. And it hurt because often I got attacked for being an artist designer, for being a woman, for wanting to be younger than I am.
But technology did start to catch up with her ideas. A growing movement of scientists and thinkers became interested in this idea of breaking the natural lifespan. They're called transhumanists, and they hold conferences on how to live forever.
Life is sort of like a symphony. You can't just gain more meaning of it by stretching it out. If you took Beethoven's Ninth and made it twice as long, it would be dreary.
William Hurlbut is a professor at Stanford and a critic of transhumanism. He served on President Bush's Council of Bioethics.
If we all live to be 150, when we're doing the President's Council report, I calculated that if everybody lived that long, then the newborn baby would have 64 great-great-great-great-great-grandparents, 32 of the next category, 16. I mean, they'd be so distanced both genetically, culturally, and there'd be so many of them, you couldn't even make meaningful family out of it.
What bothers him most is that Natasha's idea of personal growth is to tamper with millions of years of human evolution.
They could say, well, evolution moves on. Yeah, but evolution does so with a tremendous cost of suffering and struggle. And what we should never do is try to pretend that we're going to outrun suffering and death. If we seek the moral and spiritual meaning of our lives in the midst of our suffering, we would be far more richly rewarded than if we try to escape them through biotechnology. You are beautiful.
We all have parts of ourselves that we'd like to change. But we know that being human is to accept your own limitations. We hear this message all the time. Christina Aguilera thinks you're beautiful. Lady Gaga is proud to sing Born This Way. But Natasha Vita Moore doesn't think that we should settle for our birthday suits.
As much as I like being human and as much as I respect our humanity and our level of empathy and our problem-solving capabilities, we're just not all that smart. We are unable to solve the problems at the level they need to be solved.
So it's like when someone says, oh, you're only human. We're only human.
Right. I can make all the mistakes in the world and I can screw up so many times because, after all, I'm only human. I say, come on, we can do better than that.
For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky. Still human for now. I am beautiful.
We really do want to know what you think about transhumanism and the other existential questions we've been asking on today's show. Do you worry we're messing with stuff we shouldn't be messing with? Or are you excited about the miracles and wonders on the way? Or both? Tell us at studio360.org. We're going to close the show today with a little parable from the great science fiction writer Terry Bisson. It's a reminder that as advanced as we humans may become, we are not necessarily the be-all and end-all of evolution.
Look at that. They're made out of meat.
Meat?
Meat. They're made out of meat.
Meat.
There's no doubt about it. We picked several from different parts of the planet, took them aboard our recon vessels, probed them all the way through. They're completely meat.
That's impossible. What about the radio signals?
They use radio waves to talk, but the signals don't come from them. The signals come from machines.
So, who made the machines? That's who we want to contact.
They made the machines. That's what I'm trying to tell you. Meat made the machines.
Okay, that's ridiculous. You're asking me to believe in sentient meat.
I'm not asking you, I'm telling you. These creatures are the only sentient race in the sector, and they're made out of meat.
Okay, maybe they're like the Orphali. You know, a carbon-based intelligence that goes through a meat stage.
No, they're born meat and they die meat. We studied them for several of their lifespans, which didn't take too long. We all know the lifespan of meat.
Ugh. Maybe they're like the Weddellae, a meathead with an electron plasma brain inside.
No, we thought of that. They're meat all the way through.
No brain.
Oh, there's a brain. There's a brain, all right. It's just that the brain is made out of meat.
So, what does the thinking?
You're not understanding. The brain does the thinking. The meat.
You're asking me to believe in thinking meat.
Yes, thinking meat. Conscious meat. Loving meat. Dreaming meat. The meat is the whole deal. Are you getting the picture?
They're made out of meat?
And they've been trying to get in touch with us for almost 100 of their years.
So, what does the meat have in mind?
First, it wants to talk to us. Then, I imagine it wants to explore the universe, contact other sentients, swap ideas and information, the usual.
We're supposed to talk to meat.
That's the idea. That's the message they're sending out by radio. Hello, anyone there? Anyone home? That sort of thing.
They actually talk, then. They use words and ideas and concepts.
Oh, yes. Except they do it with meat.
I thought you just told me they use radio.
They do, but what do you think is on the radio? Meat sounds. You know how when you slap or flap meat, it makes a noise? They talk by flapping their meat at each other. They can even sing by squirting air through their meat.
Oh, my God. Ugh, this is too much. What do you advise?
Officially or unofficially?
Both.
Officially, we're required to contact, welcome, and log in any and all sentient races or multi-beings in the quadrant without prejudice, fear, or favor. Unofficially, I would advise that we erase the records and forget the whole thing.
I was hoping you would say that.
It seems harsh, but there's a limit.
Okay, how many planets are we dealing with here?
Just one. They can travel to other planets in special meat containers, but they can't live on them. Being meat, they only travel through sea space, which limits them to the speed of light and makes the possibility of their ever making contact pretty slim. Infinitesimal, in fact.
So we just pretend there's no one home in the universe.
That's it?
Okay, and the ones who've been aboard our vessels, the ones you've probed, you're sure they won't remember?
They'll be considered crackpots if they do. We went into their heads and smoothed out their meat, so we're just a dream to them.
A dream to meet. How strangely appropriate that we should be meat's dream.
And we can mark this sector unoccupied.
Okay, agreed. Officially and unofficially, case closed. Any others? Anyone interesting on that side of the galaxy?
Yes, a rather shy but sweet hydrogen core cluster intelligence in a class 9 star in G445 zone. It was in contact 2 galactic rotations ago. Wants to be friendly again.
They always come around.
Why not? Imagine how unbearably, how unutterably cold the universe would be if one were all alone.
They're Made Out of Meat by the writer Terry Bisson. It was first published in 1981. Our version was performed by Miriam Tolan and Russ Armstrong. Jonathan Mitchell produced and directed. And this is your final reminder for our latest extra credit project. The deadline for our DJ Rupture Music Remix Challenge is this Sunday. DJ Rupture gave us some tracks he recorded for you to download, remix, and post to our SoundCloud page. In a couple of weeks, Mr. Rupture himself will pick a winner. Here's one we got from Pete V of Madison, Wisconsin. And here's another from Hayes Holiday of Virginia. You can find out all the details about how to enter our remix challenge at studio360.org. And that is it for today's show. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen to our next one. You can hear all the other stories in our Science and Creativity series at studio360.org. Studio 360 is a co-production of PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Julia Barton,
Mujahid Solomon,
Julia Wetherill.
Our Science and Creativity editor is Jessica Benko. Thanks, as always, to Chris Bannon of WNYC. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, have you ever noticed that pop songs these days are not so poppy?
I remember when we broke up the first time.
Why major hits are minor key. Next time in Studio 360. From PRI and WNYC.
What?
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.